Loud. Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to this latest episode of Magnified with Matt Cooper, in which I speak to people who've had fascinating careers in entertainment or business or politics or today sport, because Conor Nyland has just written his autobiography about his time on the tennis circuit. And he didn't enjoy the heights like an Andre Agassi, who has the most storied autobiography from sport, perhaps, but Conor Nyland tells some terrific stories and provides an incredible insight into what it's like to be an aspiring professional athlete. And you can hear that in just a moment. And with thanks, of course, this podcast comes to you with the support of Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business. And that is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Conor Nyland, thank you for joining me for Magnified. I had you in on The Last Word recently talking about your book, The Racket, on tour at tennis's golden generation and the other 99% of which you were part. And I was fascinated by the book and I didn't get enough time with you on the radio. So thank you for coming in again.
Great to be here.
And the real thing I'm really interested in talking to you about, the topic, I suppose, that really jumped out at me, is motivation. Mm. I'm fascinated by how you were motivated to stick with it. And also we'll get to maybe the role of your parents in all of that as well. Because I often wonder how much of things are self-motivated, that it has to come from within, and how much is imposed upon you by others. What was it for you?
Yeah, and I think it started as self-motivation, but it was just, I enjoyed tennis and loved playing, and I had a role model in my sister and loved whacking the ball around, and I was good at it. And then probably to the age of 9, 10, 11, it was like that. And then when I started to, start to play the big national events and start to travel internationally, it started to become practice as opposed to play. And that's when it starts to get a little bit more feeling like homework as opposed to just messing around and being good at something. And that's, I remember that was the first bit of tension, maybe when I didn't necessarily want to practice every day or 6 days a week, even though that was what was needed. So that was when there was maybe a little bit of a push and a pull. And the first line of the book or after the prologue, it's, talking about quitting and telling my parents at sort of 10, 11, that was sort of when I wanted to take a bit of a break. And my parents sort of pushing back, going, no, they wanted the best for me, wanted me to keep playing. So that, it started at that early age. But then as a 29-year-old, I'm still out on the tour and still unbelievably motivated to try and achieve things in tennis. So I started to become, it came back to me again. It sort of went to, my motivation was sort of passed over to my parents for a little while and then sort of passed back to me after a while.
That you still went to 29, though, is remarkable, isn't it? There are few enough tennis players who are in your sort of level who continue to that age.
Yeah, I mean, I did obviously go to college in the States and went to Berkeley and played college tennis there for 4 years. So it wasn't like I went on the tour at 15 or 16 and was still out there at 29. And that was my only life. So even though I was playing, a high level of tennis in college in the States, I had a normal life between the age of 16 and 23, that maybe you don't have on the tour. And I think if I had gone pro earlier, like some guys do, I don't know if I would have stuck around at 29 and maybe at 23, 24 gone, I have had enough of this.
But how high might you have gone? I mean, you're the highest ranked Irish tennis player ever by getting to 129 in the world. But if you had gone a different route and gone to the tour and got more training earlier, how high might you have gone?
Well, this is it. I mean, we found ourselves at Politieri Tennis Academy, the greatest tennis academy in the world, at 16, me and my friend Stephen Nugent, and we were training with the Williams sisters and Peter Korda, Andy Roddick. We were getting unbelievable exposure, and I felt like I was getting better nearly by the hour when I was over there in that environment. And they offered us a place at the end of the 2 weeks, and we both went back to our old safer kind of existences back in Ireland and England. And I don't know why, but we felt like maybe it was too, our parents thought it was too big a leap, too big a jump. We wanted to go the safer route. But again, yeah, I probably would have been a better tennis player and had a higher ranking, but maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe it wouldn't have worked out that cleanly.
It's a little bit vague in the book as to how serious that offer was. I mean, what sort of offer was it, in the sense of, it wasn't a sort of a scholarship? It
it's requiring
your parents to pony up a lot of money.
And, you know, that's a very fair point. And we never quite got to that probably second conversation, but you're right. There was the 2 weeks that had gone great. We'd started in this this group that was miles off the first court. After one shot, they realised, oh, these guys are international junior level players. They thought we were just two lads over, I don't know, for a couple of weeks for a camp. So then after a day and a half, whatever, we were with the Williams sisters, you know, the top court. And after 2 weeks, this gentleman, you know, asked for a meeting with my parents, went over there with me and Stephen, and they called us into this canopied area beside the courts and sat down and said, listen, we love how you guys work. We'd love to have you back, you know, if it's something you'd consider. And we just sort of went off, talked amongst ourselves, and there was no sort of, is that a 100% scholarship? Is that a 50% scholarship? Is that, what is that? And that conversation never happened. I think they probably would have given us some sort of a scholarship if we needed it, because we were that kind of level. But yeah, we never had that second stage.
Because the other thing, that one of the many things that's fascinating in this great book, is how even when you were in your mid-20s, you were learning things as to how to improve your game, which possibly you should have learned a decade earlier.
Totally. I mean, eat simple stuff like, you know, nutrition and psychology, things that really helped me. I was maybe learning at 28, 29. I remember sending in my food diary for my week on tour to Karina Tobin, was the nutritionist I was working with. I think she was working with the Dublin Footballers at the time as well. And I sent her in my food diary. She's like, it's great, but it's, you know, it's a bowl of cereal and two slices of toast. It's like what people who are going into an office are eating. You need to be, you know, throwing three eggs in a smoothie and all the rest on top. So simple things, but I get that information at 27, 28. And then, technical things, you know, Joe Dwyer, who I talk about, my eccentric coach, who I started working with in my mid-20s, really helped me develop a slice backhand, which I never had, a running forehand. Again, things that, you know, I should have probably had in my arsenal at 17 or 18 if I was playing full-time and getting the best coaching. So I was kind of piecing all this together, and that's why my highest ranking was at the age of 29. And, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. You know, you should really be peaking at 24, 25, and then you hang on at that level and hopefully have 6 or 7 years there, whereas I only had one or two.
So there's so many things that I want to ask you about. I mean, tennis, for those people who have played tennis, I mean, when most of us, like myself, is our hack around a court, we're lucky if we can keep a rally going. We're lucky if we can get a serve in. You, on the other hand, are playing at such a level, but what's the difference when you're in the 100s in the world with the elite players we might watch on television? Are they more powerful in their serve? Do they hit harder shots? Are they more consistently getting the ball to the baseline, putting pressure on the returner? What are the things that make the elite players different?
Yeah, it's yes, yes, and yes to all those. The very, very top guys have the absolute full package. You know, you don't realize how big these guys are until you're standing beside them, like Murray, Djokovic, Nadal. They're all 6'2", 6'3". But they move like guys who are, you know, 5'8" or 5'9". They cover the ground so well, it's really hard to get the ball past them. When I trained with Andy Murray in London a couple of times, I felt like I was thinking, how am I going to accumulate points here? You know, what can I do? He's serving at 135 miles an hour. He doesn't miss a return. And when he does, it's on your toes. Like when I was playing Djokovic at the US Open, I was still almost in my service motion when the ball was at my feet. Like I was coming out of my service motion. I was still a little bit crouched and was coming up.
And he'd returned
To get ready for it. And the ball was already down my throat. And it's a subtle enough difference in terms of the depth that they hit the ball. Like to make it to the top 100 or 150 in the world, you need to be very consistent. So, you know, all the players, they don't really miss. But the Djokovic's and the Murray's and the Nadal's, they are able to hit the ball literally between 2 and 3 feet from the baseline consistently over and over again, no matter where they are on the court. And then they obviously have their weapons as well. So it's probably a simple answer, but they have just the full package. Plus, you know, when it gets really tight and gets really tough, they seem to be the guys who never choke. They never dip. They don't get angry. Okay, there's occasionally some outbursts, but they seem to be able to max that out as well.
You're very honest in the book about the times that essentially you did choke.
Mm.
Again, how much might that have stopped you realizing your full physical potential?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the match against Mannarino at Wimbledon, I was up 4-1 double break.
This is in the first round. You've made it past the qualifying round and you're in Wimbledon.
I'm in Wimbledon.
To play Roger Federer in the next round.
The winner plays Roger Federer on a guaranteed centre court match with all that he'd done on the tour, and choked and was kind of choked, to be honest, in my last round of qualifying at Wimbledon as well, but I got over the line. I was 2 sets to love up and 5-1, and I think I was 5-4 by the time I actually won that. I was incredibly nervous. It was actually a different type of a nerves than I felt in the first round. In the match against Mannarino, I started to get too aggressive too quickly in the rally and made a lot of mistakes, but I actually never felt a huge amount of physical nerves in the way I did against in the last round of qualifying. But I think that my age definitely played into that. I think the fact that I was experiencing this for the first time at 29 and knew I was going to have slim, more opportunities for this type of situation. You know, if I was 21 or 22, you know, my first round win at Wimbledon, I was probably going to go and do this for another 10 or 15 years playing this tournament. Whereas I knew deeply that this was maybe my one chance to get on centre court at Wimbledon. So it was a heavier kind of pressure again, even than somebody who's maybe a little bit younger.
Because reading through it as well, and you go through many of the games that you played at various times in your career, and I was struck by at times that you seemed regretful that maybe you were a little bit too passive at times. And then also, and this maybe sounds a bit contradictory, but that at times you were impatient.
Yeah, and that was the thing with the Mannarino finish. Was I'd been working for the previous couple of years on being aggressive, and that was what I felt like had gotten me to the next level, where I was starting to play Grand Slam main draws. And I always had a natural predisposition to be a little bit passive, especially when I got ahead. It's like a soccer team that's defending a lead and they just all camp back. I had a tendency to do the equivalent of that in tennis. So then when I got to the 4-1 against Mannarino, I said, I got to stay aggressive. I got to stay on the front foot here. And obviously I overcooked it and the match got away from me very quickly. And I think when you get nervous, you're not comfortable. And obviously if you're not comfortable, you start to make rash decisions and you start going for the bigger shot too early in the rally. So I was going for the big winner down the line in the third shot of the point, whereas the whole match previous I'd been doing it later in the rally and being a lot more patient and building the point, which I, you know, that chapter, The Longest Day, where I take you through that chapter, that whole match against Mannarino, build the point is a constant reminder that I have and a cue in my brain for doing the right thing, but it obviously got away from me at the end.
I know you got assistance from Gavin Cooney in sort of editing the book and the rest of it. I believe you sat down with him and watched some of the games, did you?
That's right. Yeah, so I have a degree in English from Berkeley. I wrote a lot of this. A lot of the prose is mine. Gavin was also very involved and we dovetailed on this a lot, and he was brilliant to work with. And yeah, we sat down and I dusted off the old DVD of the Mannarino match. It had been sent to me a couple of weeks after I lost, and I couldn't bear to look at it, to be honest. And then we took an afternoon and sat down and watched the 4 hours, give or take. We fast forwarded, you know, a few bits, and it was really interesting to watch it back. You know, it was interesting. I couldn't barely remember whether I'd won the second set or the third set or the fourth set. You know, I couldn't even remember I knew it was obviously best of five. I knew it was 6-4 in the fifth. I knew there'd been a tie break in between, but I couldn't necessarily tell you. So going through that was really interesting. And yeah, we were able to take you through almost not a shot-by-shot account, but that chapter is really, really detailed and I think is quite unique in terms of you're getting inside the head of somebody who's playing a match at Wimbledon, and I think it works really well, that chapter.
You're remarkably honest in all of this, but the other thing that struck me is almost the loneliness of the sport. You, not just on the court, when you're on your own, you're not like in a team sport when you can rely on somebody else. And there are many sports that are like that, that where you are on your own. But also outside of that, I mean, just how lonely the whole Futures Tour and Challengers Tour seems to be. I mean, you're right. I think Andy Murray comes across as a decent guy from your interactions with him, limited as they were. But it seems like everyone else is just ignoring everyone else deliberately.
Yeah, I think you've got your own little teams, and it's a lonely sport anyway. And then I was a bit of an interloper and being an Irish player as well. Now, we obviously had guys like James McGee, who were on the tour at the time. He was a bit younger than me and was playing a slightly different kind of a tour at that time. So we didn't travel together. So I was the Irish guy at these tournaments, whereas, you know, there might have been six or seven Germans and six or seven French guys who just naturally were going to be out to dinner and having the laugh away from the court that I wasn't getting. So I think a lonely sport anyway. So yeah, I was having dinners alone. And the first few tournaments out of college, I hadn't really planned for that. I thought there was going to be a little bit more camaraderie, and there really isn't. And especially when on the Futures Tour, you might see a guy at a tournament 1 week and you mightn't see him again for 6 months. So I started to work with a coach and bring a coach with me, as much for the company as much for the conversation at dinner as the necessarily the work on court.
It would have been all very different though if you'd been in the top 100, wouldn't it? Your life would have been very different in the way that all of these tournaments and everything would have been organised.
Yeah, you know your schedule when you're in the top 100 and the players are kind of all on the same path. I think you're able to forge. Certainly people are a lot more civil in the top 100, I would say. Things can get a little bit, I suppose, not heated, but when you're, you know, 500-600 in the world, you know these guys aren't necessarily, you're not necessarily going to see them again. Whereas the guys in the top 100 need to practice together, kind of live together, see each other in the same hotels all the time. So there's a kind of veneer maybe of politeness and civility. They're like colleagues almost, these guys in the top 100. But yeah, it's not the most, not the most welcoming world. You're not sort of, you know, welcomed with open arms when you go to a tournament, because ultimately you're another guy that the rest of the guys need to beat.
It struck me you didn't play on for too much longer after you had your experience at Wimbledon and also the US Open. And I won't go into that now, because the story's been well told about how you were ill when you were playing Novak Djokovic and you had to leave the court. But you didn't play on for an enormous amount of time afterwards, partly down to injuries with your hips. But it did strike me as well how much of it was down to the fact that you were actually entering an adult relationship with the woman who is now your wife, Sinead, that in itself possibly changed your focus and your motivation.
Yeah, no, exactly right. Obviously, when I retired, I gave the reason as requiring hip surgery, which was completely true. And I got hip surgery and I was going to need to take 6 months out. But the reality was I had played two Grand Slams now. That had been the huge dream for me. I was, as you say, I'd met Sheena. We were going out probably a year at that stage, and I don't think I was prepared to go and do 30, 35 weeks a year in my early 30s. And if I was making good money and it was a legitimate, you know, income, then yes, that kind of decision would have been probably a little bit more difficult. But yeah, it was a case that it was a number of factors. But yeah, the fact that I played the Grand Slams, I was able to sort of tick that box. If I'd had surgery, maybe I could have played a few more. And it's an incredibly, incredibly difficult lifestyle. If you're not, again, if you're in the top 100 or top 50, you can maybe travel with your partner and, you know, build a life that way. But when you're, you know, at the level I was at, it was going to be off on my own. And yeah, it just wasn't really feasible.
It is funny though, when you talk about Sheena going to her first tournaments and literally sitting down beside the top players and dragging you along the things that you would never have dreamt of doing yourself.
Yeah, exactly. She brought a great perspective, and she'd played tennis a little bit growing up, but yeah, hadn't obviously, you know, didn't know all the players, that's for sure. And yeah, we were at the US Open, and she came over with me for that tournament where I played Djokovic, and sort of Juan Martín Del Potro was on one table on his own and was being left alone. And Sheena, they're quite busy, these canteens, certainly at the start of the tournament. And there was a bit of space beside him. And she was like, sure, let's sit here. And I'm like, Sheena, he won the tournament 2 years ago. I can't sit beside him. And of course, we sat down, and sure, he didn't bat an eyelid. But again, it was sort of me putting these guys on a bit of a pedestal, maybe, that I think it kind of helped me with a bit of perspective in some ways. That
your parents feature throughout the book. And it's very clear love that you have for them, because even the way you write about your father's illness when he died not long after you had retired from the sport, but the amount of time that they dedicated to it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how much have you thought about that as to why they did that?
Yeah, it was incredible. Well, my dad was, you know, a high level Gaelic footballer. He played for Mayo. He was in an All Ireland semi final. Came off after half an hour with a hamstring pull, actually, against Kerry. But he used to say that his parents didn't actually. He didn't say it necessarily as a negative. It was more just a fact, and maybe it was just the time, you know, and the culture back then. But he said his parents never really. Barely came to watch him play football. You know, maybe they'd go to a final or something, but it was completely his own thing. And I think he sometimes felt like, God, I could have maybe done with a little bit more help or a little bit more support. And so he and my mum were just, yeah, unbelievably engaged and supportive and invested in all our sporting careers. My brother Ray with the rugby and Gene and Ross with the tennis and myself. And yeah, I sometimes am a bit admiring how committed they were. It was so important to them and I took it for granted. And now, you know, kids of my own and yeah, the amount of, like he was in Singapore and Japan with me, you know, in his late 60s and I'm 30 and we're traveling together, you know, sharing a room. He's still working as a surgeon back in Limerick and he's taking time out to come and go on these trips with me. And I say it in the book, I say, you know, there's something maybe, is this strange or should we be here traveling together, these father and son? But it was at the same time, the amount of time I got to spend with him, certainly in those last few years, and he was able to travel with me, I cherish, because as you say, he passed away I got the diagnosis almost a year to the day from when I retired, and then 6 months later he passed away, October 2013, and yeah, I really cherish those one-on-one times I had with him, you know, into my late 20s and early 30s that not everybody gets with their dad.
What's your tennis involvement now?
So I'm the Davis Cup captain for Ireland, which non-playing, which means
that... Sorry, clearly from the book, you loved playing Davis Cup as well, because even for the shortcomings of Tennis Ireland, at least the organisation was taken out of your hands.
Yeah, I love Davis Cup. I still love it. You'd be, you know, in with the guys for the week. I'd get, you'd be giggling for the week with the guys. It was, you know, the build-up to the big match of the weekend.
Team sport
so
as against
fun.
Individual, really.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I'd get nearly the Davis Cup blues then on the Monday and Tuesday when it was all over, because you'd miss the camaraderie. And I really get the whole post-football, post-rugby challenges. I'd say guys must find it really difficult, having been their whole lives in a dressing room with guys and working towards something, and then that goes very quickly. I didn't have that problem in some ways, obviously, because it was such a solitary existence as a tennis player. But I love Davis Cup. I'm the non-playing captain, so we have two ties a year. So we played Austria in February in Limerick, which is a fantastic event. Dominic Thiem, who's won US Open, was down there. And we have Tunisia in September, but it's not the type of, it's very much a part-time role. We don't have the budget for me to be doing it any more than outside those 2 weeks. I obviously monitor the guys. We have a Christmas camp, a summer camp, where we bring the guys together, but some of them aren't playing full-time tennis. But we're actually in a pretty good place. We just had a Group 1 playoff match, and that's my only really involvement outside my kids starting to play now, but that's kind of it.
So, okay. So what age are your children now?
7 and 5.
Okay. And are they already swinging a racket on a regular basis?
Yeah, I mean, they had a little lesson last night up at the tennis club, and I was up kind of half watching, but not hugely. Sort of, I'm pretty hands off, actually. I don't know. I sometimes think I'm probably erring on the side of caution on that. I'm certainly not overly hands on with it.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering about, as to, you know, how much you would want them to do. If they show a talent, are you going to be like your father in the way pushing them? And then would you say, well, because I didn't do this, maybe they should do that? Or will you rely on their own self-motivation, or will you motivate them for them?
Yeah, it almost looks like it's flipping a little bit again. As I say, my dad's dad, very hands off. My dad then did the opposite with me, was, you know, very engaged, and maybe I'm flipping it back. I'm probably a bit of a combination. No, I'm very much interested in tracking what they're doing. I do get out on court with them sometimes, but I find myself thinking, God, I should probably take them out to play tennis today. And between one thing and the other, it mightn't happen. So I'm certainly not, you know, 7 in the morning bucket of balls saying, come on, guys, let's play. I'm not doing that. I'm kind of trying to let it happen a bit organically, see if they have a real passion for it, a talent for it, but leaving them open to everything. So I know that's a sort of a safe, boring answer, but that kind of is what's happening. I think I'm fairly balanced with it.
Something else that struck me reading the book is that you've seen the world and yet you've seen very little of it.
That's right. Yeah. No, I was almost obsessed with this energy conservation, and I'd be travelling to places and staying off my feet.
Sorry, you have been as far away as Siberia and almost this most southern tip of Chile.
all in the 1 year. Yeah, exactly. I was in, I think I started 1 year in Australia, and finished back in Australia, in Tasmania, the very southern tip, and in, as you say, Siberia in between. But you still, the culture and the, I was always trying to minimize culture shock a little bit, and you're almost trying to keep things as similar as possible from week to week, because you're just trying to perform and trying to win tennis matches. So if I'm out sightseeing and, you know, sampling the local cuisine and all the rest, the irony, of course, is I got food poisoning in New York City, as you know, I was surprised
by that, because you ate a pork salad, and earlier in the book you had pointed out that you didn't eat salads anywhere because you were afraid of the water in which they were washed in, and then you actually broke your own rule at the most important time.
So the two times I got food poisoning on the Pro Tour was in New York, the other time was in Surrey in England, again, because
wasn't all these dodgy countries are as we would perceive them to be.
I ate like I would at home, you know, it was salads and normal. I kept things very, very tight in terms of when I was traveling. I'd go very simple, and it'd be plain rice and potatoes and some chicken breast or whatever, and peeled fruit. And then, yeah, exactly. So there was an irony there.
With the fact that you traveled the world and you didn't actually see an awful lot of these places that you might never get the opportunity to go back to again.
I know. And I don't know if I want to go back to some of them, to be honest. But and even when I finished, I had this sort of habit of kind of staying off my feet and resting, and Sheena would be like, come on, like, what are you, like, you haven't got a tennis match later or tomorrow, you don't need to be, you know, resting up on the couch at 6 o'clock, we can go out and do stuff. And I almost had to get out of the habit of that, which was funny.
Looking back on it all, I mean, it's been a remarkable life, a remarkable professional sporting career of the like that I think few enough Irish people have had. So was it all worth it?
Yeah, I think it was. I definitely would have done a few things differently. As we said, I would have maybe gone a little bit more towards that academy route a little bit earlier, while still potentially going to college in the States. Was it worth it? Just about. I'm really glad I got to play those Grand Slams. If I hadn't done that, I think I would have had a lot more regrets, and I'm a lot more at peace with it, the fact that I not only played Grand Slams, I got to play on a major court, even though I was sick. And now, as I say, I've got a book about it. And if you told me at 13 or 14, I'd have a couple of Grand Slams played and written a book about the whole experience, I probably would have said that's a pretty cool outcome. So no, I'm happy enough.
And what about life outside of tennis? Do you have a career now?
Yeah, so I work at Cushman & Wakefield. I'm in commercial property. So I went back and did a master's in real estate in Bolton Street after I finished. And I've been working in commercial property about 10 years this summer, which has flown.
Do a lot of the other tennis players find alternative careers, or have they become so wrapped up that they don't prepare themselves for other lives?
Yeah, I think it must be difficult if you go full time at 16 and you come out of the tour at 32, 33 to reinvent yourself. I think the fact that I went to college in the States really helped me with my transition. But I think most tennis players tend to do okay. I think it is such a challenging life and quite a structured existence in its own way. I think it sets you up pretty well for post playing. You know, you hear some stories, maybe again going back to the team sports, they're told what to wear, this is the bus, your hotel, this is your flight, this is your passport, you know, work away. And whereas with us, we had to organize the hotels, the flights, everything. And I think it sets you up pretty well, so I'm pretty self-reliant, and I think most tennis players are probably pretty similar.
And would you recommend it as a life for young Irish athletes? Because if you're not playing in a team sport, you might have options like be it boxing or I'm thinking snooker, I'm thinking solitary swimming.
Yeah, golf.
Golf, gymnastics, whatever. You know, are these sports, coming from a small country like Ireland where we don't have the infrastructure for minority sports, is it possible to become a success? And I know golf is an example in which we have had a number of major winners in a particular period, but we might be experiencing a little bit of a fallow period now for new golfers coming through. Is Ireland set up to succeed in minority sports?
Yeah, for tennis, we definitely, we don't have the same infrastructure as, you know, your other comparable countries, you know, like your Hollands, your Belgiums, your Denmarks, that are a smaller population. So, you know, I'd love to see a main tour event in Ireland, whether that's men's or women's. I think it would give us a slot in the diary of the sports calendar for the year in Ireland. I think people would be able to get behind it. And then we just need more international tournaments, whether that's junior or professional, just to give people more opportunity to play, win matches, earn money at home, so they're not having to get on flights all the time and do it the way I did it. But listen, I think there's worse things you can be doing in your life than chasing a dream and trying to become a tennis player. So I don't think it's all bad.
And it's a great read that they got out of it in the end. The Racket, highly recommended on tour with tennis's golden generation and the other 99%, of which you were one, Conor Nyland. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a million, Matt. Cheers.
So that's it for today's Magnified with Matt Cooper. Hope very much you enjoyed that. Loads of other interviews that you can go back and listen to if you want something to do over the summer months. If you liked it, please recommend to a friend. You can do that. Tell them it's on the Go Loud app, or it's on Apple, or it's on Spotify, or wherever. So until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper, again with thanks to our sponsors at Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing, regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Thanks very much for listening.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.